Well, yes. Beware, reader. Beware of dogs and snakes and women when they glare like Thisbe did. Stupid. That's what it is. You cousins ban everything under the sun and then make a million loopholes so no one ever has to follow their own rules. What's the point of having the laws if there's no consequence in breaking them? Carlyle stared, unbelieving, as her tirade left all stealth behind. Thisbe, is this the time for hypocrites, always moralizing about how yours is the strictest law? Dominic Seneschal is a maniac, but at least they picked a law they'll follow, while you all go on about being stricter than a white law and then walk straight into a brothel. Her outburst was surreal. A game. That's what it felt like, as if the two had been playing an infiltration game and Thisbe hit pause, expecting the rules and enemies to wait for her rant as they might wait for a bathroom break or a trip to grab more munchies. Gaping Carlyle still believes the danger and mission here are real. The clearing of a throat interrupted. Can I help you two fine people? The voice came from the window closest above the back door. Here stood a resident to match the house. She wore an antique gown, the skirts vast with stiff frames underneath, while the tight corset exaggerated her sex, the upper line presenting her breasts like a platter of pudding, while the corset's lower edge came to a central point, directing the eye to the spot in the ocean of skirting where lurked her most forbidden part. One could not guess her age beneath the white face powder, two pink circular blotches on the cheeks, sharp lipstick, and of course the wig, a tower of mounded, stiffened curls, with a cluster of feathers sprouting from its peak like a nesting bird. Other faces framed her in the window, and more appeared through the drapes of surrounding windows, painted ladies like the first, youths with curled ponytails like Dominic's, and younger girls with blushing, modest cheeks tittering at the strangers on the steps, as if they had been the burlesque, and these creatures normal. Are you lost? The first whore invited. In this chapter, reader, I shall call a spade a spade. You'll get back to the river if you head straight that way. No, Thisbe answered. We're not lost. We're looking for, Mason, Carlyle ventured, covering the intentional blurring of the first name by reaching to scratch his nose at that opportune moment. Fast as a match to oil, the name set French gossip exploding across the spectators. Mason? I'm afraid the Emperor just left, the whore replied, hissing quick hushes to the nearby window gapers. Should I get one of his secretaries for you? No, I don't mean the Emperor, Mycroft said they'd be... Mycroft? The whore repeated. Her face suddenly light. Oh, bless me, you want the young Master Jehovah Mason. I'm sorry, I'm not used to hearing him called by his last name. Sir Eloise, she shouted toward an upper window. Invité pour Maître Jehovah. Only Thisbe catching him kept Carlyle from falling backwards down the steps. Jehovah? She'll be right down. The whore smiled. Sorry about the confusion. It's not often anyone new comes for the young master. Through the windows, one could track Eloise's approach by the polite bobbed nods of those she flitted past. I was still concocting schemes to stop them. What options had I left? They certainly weren't prepared to listen to my excuses. If I called President Ganymede, he could caution Thisbe to back off. She might listen, but not Carlyle, who teetered now on the steps like a tree half-felled in one stroke. Jehovah? He repeated. Are you feeling all right, father? The whore asked, frowning down at the censer through the lipstick which did not so much frame her mouth as mark the twin peaks of her upper lip like two tiny strawberries. You look pale. Do you need some brandy? They're fine. Thisbe pretended, doing her best to prop Carlyle between her body and the dainty banister. Carlyle, deep breaths. The door opened before them now. revealing a tiny creature, fragile but overflowing with energy like a hummingbird. "Oh, Evans, this won't do at all." She relieved Thisbe at once, tipping Carlyle's full weight onto her shoulders, which, in their tininess, seemed like they should snap. "You must come in at once. I'll send for a nurse. Candide!" She shouted to a gawking youth above, "Cherche-toi l'infirmière!" "No, it's okay." Carlyle seized the rail with all his strength and tried to stand. "I just had a little faint spell. I'm fine, really."
"Are you certain?" Eloise asked.
Her face was clean and plain with that natural beauty which makes young princes hunger for shepherdesses, and made Carlyle smile in the moment before he saw her clothes. She wore a shapeless cotton smock, straight black down to her ankles, with a white tabard over the top, and a crisp white wimple covering her throat, brows, and forehead, so not a strand of hair showed through. Though none have walked our streets for 9 generations, how many seconds would it take you, reader, to recognize a nun? "There's nothing wrong with that cousin that a little food and spirits won't put right," the whore called down. "Eloise, take them through to the Salon Hogarth. I'll send for something."
"Right away," the nun confirmed.
Though willing to let Carlyle walk, she would not release his arm, leading him firmly, like a half-blind great uncle.
"This way, Father."
Sister Eloise, not I, made them cross that threshold, though the panic which froze me in inaction prevented me from stopping it. They entered a service corridor, neither wide nor grand, ornamented with delicate moldings and small, wall-mounted chandeliers which sparkled disdainfully with electric light, not quite as rich as candles. The doors along the walls were strange, all different heights and widths, some low enough to make one stoop, others curved or slanted as if they had been cut into the wall at random. The cause was clear when Eloise opened the nearest, for on the other side it was a hidden door, carefully cut to fit the gap between a fireplace and bedpost, so none within could deduce quite where the servants passed in and out. The Salon Hogarth was quiet, with leather seats and a hand-carved lady's writing desk, but dominated by a vast canopy bed and a pair of framed prints. Before showed a gentleman dragging a reluctant lady toward a bed with no little violence, while after had the lady clinging to him in affectionate desperation as he rose to replace his breeches. The pair of images would have been distressing anywhere, but were much worse in a room which was itself a precise recreation of the one shown in the illustrations.
"Please sit."
Eloise poured brandy from a bright decanter, her tabard swaying about her knees like an apron.
"Here, Father. This should give you back some fortitude."
She had the same accent as Dominic, French flavoring English as milk flavors cocoa.
"Drink it slowly."
"Stop calling me Father." I was startled as I listened. I had not thought Carlyle had it in him to make his voice so grim. "Is this a period costume brothel?" Her virgin cheeks blushed at the word.
"Parts of the house could be described that way, yes."
"And you're dressed as a nun?"
"I am a nun. I am called Sister Eloise. And what may I call you, if not Father? You are a priest, are you not?"
"A censaire."
"As I said, a priest," she smiled.
"We call things by their real names here. Now drink this, Father. It will revive your spirits." Carlyle crossed his arms in refusal. The nun frowned.
"And you, madame?"
She turned to Thisbe.
"Or is it mademoiselle?
I see you are one of the subjects of His Grace the Duc de Thouars."
"Mademoiselle," Thisbe answered.
"And if you mean President Ganymede, I'm a humanist, yes." I should have guessed Thisbe would adapt quickly to this new world and its vocabulary. "I'm Thisbe Sanir. Nice to meet you, Sister Eloise." Eloise bobbed a curtsy, which made the shadows of her tight breasts bounce beneath her habit.
It tried its best, the nun's habit, to leave her shapeless, stripping hips and curves from the figure with its clumsy folds. But all it truly did was dare one to search for them, to wonder how pert the buttocks must be to make the fabric hang so, or to mark the shapes of thighs and calves through the sackcloth.
Pleased to meet you. Marie-Thérèse said you came to see Master Jehovah.
Yes, Thisbe answered, glaring at Carlyle to keep him silent, since the name made him jolt on every repetition, like a fresh electric shock.
I'm afraid Master Jehovah is elsewhere at the moment, and occupied with high affairs, but I can request that he come and see you as soon as he is free.
That may not be necessary, Thisbe answered. I'm running a pro forma background check on Tribune Mason, to clear them for access to the Seigneur Weeksbooth Bosch House for their investigation. I'm supposed to interview close associates, routine questions.
Oh, why, then I shall answer anything you like.
Are you too close?
Very.
Thisbe had to ask it. Do you work here?
I live here, the little sister answered, and I do my work here, caring for the sick, mending, taking care of Master Jehovah's errands, and, of course, I pray for everyone.
Carlyle's fists clenched. Carlyle, Thisbe warned, relax, just relax. She sighed. I must apologize for my sincere sister. I asked them to help with my investigation only quite recently, and they were up imprudently late last night. May I? She reached to take the brandy from Eloise's fingers. Eloise surrendered the glass gladly.
It's quite all right. It's only natural for a priest to be overwhelmed by such a spiritual place. They often wind up in my hospital room at some point on first visits, though hopefully your friend is not so fragile.
Thisbe shoved the glass at Carlyle. Drink it. You need it.
A spiritual place? Carlyle repeated. A brothel?
It's more than that,
the nun corrected, beaming pride.
This is a refuge from the barbarities of the modern day. Our members come here to escape for a few hours to a more courteous and enlightened age, and return to the outside world refreshed by a taste of civilized society.
Carlyle twitched. And sex?
She pursed her lips in disapproval. You may never have endured it, reader, but the disapproval of a nun is extremely powerful.
Do you have some problem with sex?
Carlyle.
I do when you claim to be a nun.
Eloise.
Then you too advocate clerical celibacy?
Her voice grew bright, as if she had just discovered they shared the same hometown.
Carlyle. I do not advocate clerical celibacy, but I don't advocate mocking it either.
Thisbe.
Carlyle!
Thisbe's anger threatened to bring her boot down sharp upon his toe.
I think what my sensei is trying to ask, sister, is, if you don't mind a mildly indelicate question.
Eloise.
I have scrubbed bile from the floors of sick rooms. What are words to that?
Thisbe.
Well, are you a prostitute who's dressed as a nun, or are you actually pursuing a celibate lifestyle while living in a house of prostitution? You can understand my confusion. I mean, don't nuns prefer to live with other nuns?
Eloise.
You're thinking of the Tibetan and Vatican reservations. Those nuns are not my order. And the business of prostitution is limited to certain sections of this house.
Thisbe, I see.
But even if only in parts, isn't that a bit incongruous?
Eloise,
I see no incongruity in it.
Thisbe,
no incongruity in a nun being around so much erotic activity?
Eloise,
on the contrary, what could be more appropriate? Celibacy is the most extreme of sexual perversions, after all.
That one floored even Thisbe.
What?
Eloise.
Sexual desire is the purest and most natural of animal drives. To suppress it in favor of an intellectual and theological satisfaction is a perversion of nature in the most extreme sense. Why, even to fornicate alone or with many people at once, or with a machine, or an ass, or hound is closer to nature's intent than abstinence. Do you not agree? A long pause. Very long.
Carlyle.
Diderot.
Thisbe.
What? Carlyle. You're quoting Diderot. That bit about celibacy is the most unnatural thing.
Eloise.
Quite correct, father. Mademoiselle Senir, has your sensei not told you of Le Philosophe?
Denis Diderot was a great philosopher, the leader of the Encyclopedia Project.
I wish now, reader, that I had myself introduced you to Le Philosophe in some lighter hour. Grant me, if you will, a moment for his noble side, before you associate him forever with this house. Once upon a time, there was a bright young atheist named Denis Diderot. In his 18th century, atheism was just blooming, and keen libertine minds hungered for a firebrand to stir and lead them. He could have made himself the pope of atheists, but he refused. For Diderot, while denying any afterlife, dreamed of worldly immortality not for himself, but for the dead, the dreams and achievements of ages past, and for his world. His philosopher's stone would be a book. The second half contained technical plates illustrating all the technologies humanity had achieved, weaving silk stockings, annealing metal, baking bricks. So with a single copy, even the lowest peasant could reconstruct all the tools of civilization. The first half was the same for thought. Thus, if a new dark age should fall upon the earth, but a single copy of this book survived, every achievement of the human race from bronze to liberty could be restored. Diderot named this talisman of immortality Encyclopédie, and fearing that his personal beliefs might bring the wrath of the authorities upon the project, he voluntarily suppressed his own work, publishing nothing of the revolutionary atheism which like-minded doubters of his age so hungered for. The public who named Voltaire Le Patriarche dubbed Diderot Le Philosophe, the philosopher, guardian, and caretaker of all thinkers and all thought. The grand title of arch-heretic, which he deserved, he left to others, to Machiavelli, Hobbes, misunderstood Spinoza, or De Sade. Can you imagine a nobler act, reader? Sacrificing his own chance to add his voice to humanity's great conversation, to safeguard the conversation itself? And he went to jail for writing porn about nuns. Carlyle snapped it with a cutting glare. Eloise sat unfazed.
True, indeed.
Rich, beautiful, philosophical pornography about nuns. I have read it several times. Eloise turned her sincerest smile on the censeur.
Fear not, father. I do not mock those whose robe I imitate. Though sex of all sorts occurs here, I am not involved. There is music here, too. Art, scholarship, and discourse. And if there are also earthly pleasures, then they are pursued only in harmonious consort with the others, and in sections of the house which I do not frequent.
Carlyle gave up on goading her here, sensibly, for it is madness trying to anger Eloise. Anger, like envy, impatience, greed, and lust, all melt from her like frost from flame, and she takes modest pride in crushing such little demons underfoot. One thing, though, he would not give up on. I told you not to call me father.
I'm sorry. Would you prefer doctor?
Neither. I'm a sensei, not a priest. Her brows, where the wimple did not cover them, seemed sad.
Have you not dedicated your life to your God?
Thisbe forced the brandy into Carlyle's hands. Drink. You need it. Both women watched, expectant, but Carlyle just stared at his reflection in the amber spirit, as if trying to take refuge in the only thing in the room which was not mad.
Dominic Seneschal spends time here too, don't they? He asked. Do they work here?
Sister Eloise's face grew light and frantic at the same time, like a mother desperate for rumors of a runaway.
Do you have word from Brother Dominic? We've been so worried.
Brother Dominic?
Thisbe forced a smile. I'm sorry, Sister Eloise. We don't know anything about where Dominic Seneschal is or where they've been the last few days. We've been seeking them too.
I see,
Eloise answered, unable to stifle a sigh.
You know Dominic well?
We grew up here together.
You both work for Jed Jehovah?
Here you may call him the Prince d'Arwe,
if his true name makes you uncomfortable.
Either way, you and Dominic work for them?
Work for Master Jehovah? Oh no, we worship him as a god.
Even Thisbe could only feign so much calm.
What?
Dominic's path is his own. As for myself, I have consecrated my virginity to Master Jehovah, and dedicate my honors to the contemplation of his divine mysteries and the exercise of good works in his holy name. It is a vocation which fills and overflows my every thought and deed, waking and sleeping. And since Master Jehovah himself has accepted my devotion, I count myself the most fortunate of women, though not in the least deserving of such fortune.
I was in my early days a very wicked child, she continued, proud, self-involved, and filled with the most perfidious jealousies. I grew up in this house, not among the common children, but one of the elect, raised in the strictest discipline with the care of many wise and generous tutors, whose efforts on my behalf I never appreciated as they deserved. They offered for my education music, geometry, mathematics, natural philosophy, the historians, poets, orators, Latin, Greek, French, all the authors whose works are proper for the eyes of a sensitive young lady. Yet I began to spurn all in favor of the flattery of men. Puffed up by vacant words, I vainly thought myself the most beautiful of my peers, a double vanity, both because I judged myself superior, and because I placed value on appearance, as if true beauty lay in face and flesh. Wretch that I was, I cared nothing for the logic of the philosopher, the morals of the orator, or the light of the theologian. She means here Aristotle, Cicero, and St. Thomas Aquinas. When I had suitors to taunt and rivals to defeat. Here you object, impatient reader. Mycroft, thou hast lapsed too much into thy 18th century. This life story poured out all in one ramble might fit in the fabricated dialogues of thy patriarch or thy philosophe, but not in a history. No sane person disgorges her autobiography before perfect strangers, and no listener, even one as stunned as Carlyle and Thisbe, would sit through this in silence. You do not believe, reader. Then come, I challenge you. Come to her offices. Ask good Sister Eloise to tell you of her vocation, and see if you have the strength of will to interrupt a nun. She continues. In the course of things, I was betrothed to a good and worthy man, and endeavored to direct the entirety of my affection toward my intended. Yet, as I felt youth begin to flower in me, I found my passions directed as uncontrollably as water gushing from a spring, not to my fiancée, but toward Master Jehovah. Naturally, all in this house, from my sisters and brothers to the lowest scullery maid, hold Master Jehovah in the highest awe. For he is the pillar and scion of our world, the noblest of princes, most infallible of logicians, most compassionate of statesmen, and most penetrating of philosophers. Yet I, and others around me, easily saw that my affection far outstripped the common worship of the crowd. There were days when my sole hope in rising from my bed was that I might glimpse him passing in the hall, and any day his offices did not allow him to return home left me in the most profound despair. Knowing my duty, I tried to drive this love from my rebellious bosom, and that battle claimed my happiness and health. for I soon succumbed to a wasting sickness which consigned me to my bed, and very nearly to my grave. I was at first unwilling to confess the cause of my illness, but I was not so impious a child as to stay silent before Madame, when she pleaded with me with a mother's tears. With her encouragement, I revealed the truth to my fiancé, explaining that, while he retained forever a treasured quarter of my heart, my love for him had been transformed now to a daughter's devotion to her father, rather than a lady's for her lord. So kind and compassionate is the heart of that great man who was almost my husband, that he forgave me, accepting my filial affection in place of wifely love. And to save his newfound daughter from the grip of sickness, he agreed to go to Master Jehovah, whom he was accustomed to approaching with the intimacy of kin, and tell him of my love. The ways of my lord are mysterious. At first he answered nothing, and neither my newfound father nor Madame nor any in the house could understand his actions as he sequestered himself in his library, where none but the most trusted of servants were permitted to intrude. I, in my despair, slipped into a sleep so close to death that my nurses thought me a dozen times lost, but I was saved when Master Jehovah emerged from his isolation, and to the great jealousy of my sisters, who had never enjoyed more than a few syllables from his blessed lips, presented me with a commonplace book compiled by his own hand. Every page filled with quotations from the wisest ancients and most refined of commentators, interspersed with pieces of his own divine wisdom, explaining in 100 voices that appiest and archest rule, all but abandoned in this selfish age. The monastic calling. I saw at once my folly, that in the heat of youth I had imagined he could be the inspiration of a base and earthly love. That fire within myself, which I had mistaken for common passion, was in reality the first dim flickering of the truer flame of spiritual devotion, which, if fed with the good fuel of discipline and virtue, might be cultivated into some semblance of that ethereal brightness which marks mankind as the most fortunate of beasts. For we alone, of all the creatures of this earth, may aspire to the understanding of the divine. All rejoiced at my vocation, and my return from death's door, and Madame saw at once to my initiation into monastic life. I have lived so ever since, consecrated to my Lord God Jehovah in a chaste union far more powerful than any earthly marriage, and I have never strayed, nor thought to stray from this severe path, which is to me the greatest happiness. She fell into a prayer-like silence as she finished, the expression on her face a portrait of delicate, spiritual joy. They had no questions, or, more likely, they brimmed with questions, but none they thought this madwoman could answer. "Sir Eloise, please step away from the intruders." Carlyle and Thisbe were not the only ones who had been unable to interrupt the nun, but now that she had finished, both doors, main and hidden, opened, and gentlemen filled the entrances like floodwaters. I cannot remember how many there were, save 5 or 7, as you prefer, all costumed as the house demanded, silk at their throats, trim waistcoats, swallow-tailed jackets, breeches, rich fabrics with richer tailoring, and swords, half-decorative, at every belt. Their breeches were tight, far more precisely tailored than the sexless fashions of the outside world, and yesteryear's style made the conspicuous lumps of their sexual members catch the eye, even on those who had nothing more to display than a woman's crotch-bone. Yes, reader, half these gentlemen were female in body, breasts tucked snugly under the waistcoats. But with such rearing, there was no more of the female in them than there is canine loyalty in a pup raised among wolves. The fiercest, though not the largest, led the pack, his coat and breeches black, his waistcoat copper-embroidered green, his skin European pale with hints of reddish fire in his hair. "Chevalier," Eloise greeted him, "is there a problem?" These two have entered under false pretenses, he explained.
What? Thisby cried in false dismay. Oh, I forgot to share my credentials. How silly of me.
She began to call them from her tracker. The Chevalier loomed closer, and the others with him, like vultures around carrion.
No one would give you this address.
I got it from Officer Occam Sinir.
No, you did not.
The Chevalier smiled wide.
You'll come with us, please. I'm running a background check on...
You will graciously consent to come with us.
Eloise interposed herself between the censeur and the marauders like a fence of frail wicker to stop a charging bull.
These two have been consigned to my care, Chevalier. We are waiting together for Master Jehovah.
Then allow me to relieve you of that burden, Sir Eloise.
The Chevalier marshaled a smile whose malice impressed even Thisby.
I would not wish this petty affair to keep you from your sacred duties.
No sculpted angel has ever smiled so serenely. It is no burden, Chevalier.
A distraction, then, he corrected. One unworthy of your time.
The nun's eyes ranged the others, the magic of her gaze driving eager hands away from sword hilts and making smirks pregnant with mischief to grow sober.
The priest is sick, she announced. It is among the foremost of my charitable duties to help the sick.
Then, good sister, you must trust me to see that duty performed in due course. But I must also see foremost to my primary duty, to guard this house, which is my charge when Brother Dominic is absent.
Before Eloise could answer, a shout and fast feet thundered down the hall outside.
Sir Eloise! Sir Eloise! Dans la salle de douale! Senator Chung est gravement blessé.
In the dueling hall, Senator Chung is seriously wounded.
She opened the door at once.
Gravement?
Seriously?
Oui,
answered the messenger, a tearful maid of 13.
Et tous les docteurs sont occupés en bas. Viens vite.
Yes, and all the doctors are busy below. Come quickly.
I had no doubt the Chevalier had arranged the convenient timing of the injury. But the same laws of courtesy, which would not permit the men to roughhouse in the sister's presence, also would not allow her to ignore a soul in need.
You must excuse me, Father, Mademoiselle Sanir.
She bobbed a curtsy.
I am needed elsewhere urgently.
I shall return to check on you when next I am free.
She made the Chevalier meet her eyes, not easy eyes to face.
You will take proper care of these two, as Master Jehovah's guests?
The Chevalier raised his gloved hand as if to take an oath. I shall see to them according to my duty.
The little sister is no fool.
May I have your word, then, Chevalier? No harm will come to them.
Her persistence grated on him, like a song once pleasant which takes too long to end.
Very well, you have my word. Now run along, sister, blood does not wait.
She offered the stranded pair a reassuring smile.
You may trust the Chevalier to keep his word. Good luck to you. I'll keep you in my prayers.
With that, she rushed away, and decorum with her. You have never seen such dark grins on a pack of men.
Now, the Chevalier began, where were we? Ah, yes, unlawful intrusion.
Hey, look, the priest's a cousin.
Three of the pack pawed at the loose tails of Carlyle's cousin's wrap as circling bandits play with the skirts of a maiden they hunger to unwrap.
She's definitely not supposed to be here.
Here again, reader, I must apologize since I have accustomed you to assigning Carlyle he. Cousins are she by default in that house, and the exception for Carlyle had not yet been ordered.
Are you enjoying straying out of bounds, cousin?
One reached as if to stroke Carlyle's hanging hair, but instead snatched the disabled tracker from his ear and dangled it just out of reach.
Hey! Thisby cried, off guard. That's so not okay.
The Chevalier carried a cane as well as a sword, and wielded it with expert menace.
I fear it is not your place to make rules in another's house, Mademoiselle Intruder.
Thisby rose.
and with her boots was almost tall enough to face the Chevalier eye to eye. Red zone or no, taking a tracker is black law illegal. The Chevalier looked at the others, and all laughed raucously, as if she had made a brilliant joke.
I don't think you're the one who wants to call the law in here, Mademoiselle Intruder, into a level one Romanovan Alliance security compound whose unlawful breach is punishable by... He looked to his compatriots. What is it for humanists? 5 to 10? 10 to 15 years or 500,000 euros? One supplied. The answer freshened the roses in the Chevalier's cheeks. Of course, if you meant no harm by the intrusion, we might overlook it, if appropriately persuaded. Like Leslie, Thisbe has no practice dodging when one of these creatures swoops in serpent-quick to kiss her hand. Blush erupted, intense enough to show on her dark Indian cheeks, and her poise changed too, standing straighter, as if remembering her own anatomy beneath her silk suit and her pride in it. She looked to Carlyle, who had pulled his feet up onto his chair as if it were a life raft with sharks circling round. "What persuasion do you have in mind?" she asked. The Chevalier leaned close, closing his eyes a moment as he tested the scent of Thisbe's shampoo. "Let us, just you and I, go see if we can't find one of the household polylaws. Surely they can advise us on the situation, and who knows, perhaps we'll come up with something on our own along the way." He raised his hand to stroke her cheek, while his body leaned close enough for their thighs to share warmth. Thisbe froze, as Mercer Mardy froze once, hoping the killer would not spot her in the shadows. "Thisbe," Carlyle urged, "call on your tracker. We need help." If glares could kill, this would have been Carlyle's earthly end. "You doubt my word, Sensei." The Chevalier turned on him. "I promised Sister Eloise that you would not be harmed." "Thisbe," Carlyle tried again. "Thisbe," the Chevalier repeated, planting a fresh kiss on her hand and others further up her arm in an inching line. A superb name, Thisbe. More parents should be brave enough to name their daughters after women men have died for, don't you think? Thoughts and adrenaline mixed in Thisbe's mind as the inching kisses crept so slowly toward her throat. "Fly," says Virtue. "Knock his hand away. Kick him in that too conspicuous crotch. Fight. Call, as trackers can, the fierce and instant law whose agents will swoop from the heavens angel harsh and whisk you away from this strange man whose blush is rising to match yours." Thisbe smiled. "What about my sensei?" The Chevalier's eyes rolled across to Carlyle as to an unwanted sibling. "The cousin is sick, is she not? Let her recover here. My compatriots will give her the very best of care." "Thisbe," Carlyle cried out as three of them dug their fists into his clothes as if to rip the wrapping from a birthday package. "We have to get out of here. Stop. That sensei belongs to Giulia Doria Pamphili." I was so out of breath as I burst in that I could not keep my words from becoming a shout. I made it in time, barely, but I had made it in time. "Mycroft?" Thisbe, Carlyle, and the Chevalier called my name in unison, then eyed one another in some surprise. "Carlyle is Julia's apprentice," I repeated, still panting, "and this humanist is a privileged courtier of His Grace the Duc de Thouars. They would not want their creatures spoiled." The Chevalier's confederates were quick to release Carlyle, while the Chevalier himself spun toward me in the same motion, taking Thisbe in his arms. "Why did they not say so themselves?" "Because, sir, this is their first time in the civilized world. They do not yet know its ways." I lowered from my back a sack heavy with fabric. "I am to take them to Madame." In the hush, quick-thinking Carlyle managed to snatch back his tracker. The Chevalier arched perfect eyebrows. "Madame is expecting them?" "Impatiently, Chevalier." How crestfallen, his sigh. "Alas, dear Thisbe, such a summons one dares not ignore."
He would not leave her without at least one proper kiss as prize. He took it slowly, time enough not just for tongue, but for a succubus to have sucked the soul out of its prey, if such was its aim. He smiled when done, but Thisbe smiled deeper.
Perhaps another time.
Nodding to his men to follow, the Chevalier strode through the door. I was wrong to say there was no touch of the feminine remaining in the company, for, male or female, all of them moved with that artful grace we associate with ladies and dancers, as they wielded their blades as gracefully as ladies do their fans. On exit, the Chevalier glared at my servicer's uniform with proper scorn. "You mustn't let clients see you like that in the halls, Mycroft," he warned. "I won't, Chevalier." I cannot comment on his final expression, for I am not permitted to raise my eyes to one of his rank. I bowed low as I closed the door behind him.
"What are you doing here, Mycroft?"
Thisbe asked. No, the tone was grim, more an order than a question. I did not look at her. "Patronage is everything here. When in trouble, invoke the highest-ranking person you're associated with. Did you follow us here? Or were you here already?" "I'm under orders to take you to Madame. Contemporary clothing is forbidden in the inner halls. You may wear these, since we do not have time for a fitting." I drew from my sack two cloaks of floor-length dark red velvet, hooded, and heavy enough to muffle even sound. "How long have you been involved with these people?" Thisbe pressed. "Mycroft, I asked you a question."
"You can't have weapons when you see Madame," I recited. "You may give them to me. I'll return them when you leave the premises."
Thisbe crossed her arms. "You will answer me, Mycroft." "I recommend that you answer voluntarily." She took a menacing step forward. I sighed. "I noticed when Carlyle arrived in Paris. You two shouldn't be here. This is number one in the list of places in the world you shouldn't be."
"You did know about this place," Carlyle accused.
"Of course." I tossed them each a cloak. "Where J.E.D.D. Mason goes, I go."
"Jehovah Mason," he corrected.
"You knew that too?"
I hid my face by diving back into the sack for my own costume. "Tell me you didn't use the transit computers to get this address."
Thisbe's silence answered for her.
"Tell them you got it from me."
I met her eyes now.
"This is important, Thisbe.
We don't need the powers that be getting even more worried about the security of your Bosch. If anyone asks, you drugged me, and I told you this address when I was half asleep. I was the weak link, not your Bosch. Clear?"
Silence consented.
"We have to move fast," I continued. "The Chevalier will have left one of his gentlemen outside to make sure I really do take you to Madame. Put the cloaks on."
Thisbe held the garment, stubborn.
"Who's Madame?"
"The owner.
Please take me seriously when I say this. I'll die before I let you see Jehovah. He'd have the truth about Bridger out of you in 2 minutes. That will not happen while I live."
Their stares believed me.
"Rumor of your coming already reached Madame. I am under orders to bring you, and hopefully meeting her will satisfy your..." I took a deep breath.
"You shouldn't have come here. You really shouldn't have. But the faster we move, the better mood Madame will be in, and right now Madame's good humor is the only protection you have from... consequences."
Thisbe donned the cloak, the velvet hiding every inch of her. "In a place like this, I'd have expected masks, too, like carnival." I shook my head.
"You're not of the right rank for masks.
Carlyle, put your cloak on."
He glared.
Thisbe glared back.
"We don't have time for your Mycroft canner fixation right now, Carlyle. Do you want to trust Mycroft, or do you want to stay here and let them rape you?"
If Carlyle were a man who cursed, he would have done it then.
"They would have raped us, wouldn't they? Your friends."
I did not have time to argue the difference between friends and betters. No was on my lips when I realized this might be my chance. I could scare them off, concoct something horrible, 1,000 times beyond reality, but plausible in the surreality of this place. Then maybe, maybe, they would run.
They'd have raped you every way it's possible to rape someone, I began, my imagination racing. The group of them taking turns.
Then they'd have tied you up and called in whores from downstairs to join in and put you through every filthy act imaginable. But the law only counts it as rape if you still say no at the end. They'd make sure you couldn't. They'd use extremes of pain and pleasure until you'd agree to anything. Experts like that, it wouldn't take them an hour to get you to send messages to your boss and colleagues saying you were taking a vacation, so no one would look for you for weeks. Then they'd drag you to the kennels, where the real work would begin. Even before they entered the room, they were probably placing bets on who would succeed first, getting you to sign yourself over and become a black law. And once you did, you'd never leave this place again. Now put on your cloak and let me save you. I waited to see if my fantasy would work. Carlyle paled. He gagged. At last, chose the cloak. I sighed relief. Weapons, Thisbe? I pressed, offering my empty sack. Carlyle's eyes turned from hate narrow to child wide as he watched Thisbe pull from hidden places a sturdy knife, a second sturdy knife, a stun pistol, a tranquilizer pistol, and 3 flash grenades.
Thisbe, what?
My bosh is vital to the world order, remember? Occam and Cardi aren't the only ones who study self-defense. She placed the arsenal piece by treasured piece within my sack. I regretted doing this in front of Carlyle, I really did. All weapons, Thisbe. Death hate reared that instant in her glare. There are security scanners every 10 feet in the halls, Thisbe, I pressed. They'll know. I'm sorry. I'll give them back to you, I swear by Apollo Mojave. Even with that, it took her 3 long breaths to face up to the necessity. She knelt.
Thisbe, Carlyle called, what are you?
Don't ask. The clasping mechanisms exhaled long hisses as the woman removed her boots. Carlyle leaned closer.
Thisbe,
I said don't ask. Now get your fucking cloak on before you do anything else to get us in deeper shit. She set her boots in my sack, gently as a mother lays down a child, then spun to vent her wrath upon the sensei.
I don't want another word out of you, Carlyle, you hear me? Not about Mycroft or the costume. Mycroft is rescuing your stupid ass, and you're going to do everything Mycroft says to the letter until we're out of here.
Costume? Carlyle repeated it as a question, but then saw what she meant. The sack had a costume for me, too, to cover my servicer's dappling, the rough, grayish-brown habit of a Franciscan monk. To you, one monk is probably like another, since our schools don't teach their many founders' distinctive madnesses. Francis was a saint among saints, and a madman among madmen, who used to talk to birds, to ravage his own body with scourge and ice, to turn down pious hosts, preferring to beg his supper on the street, who even refused to be in command in his order, insisting that his own followers rule him so he could practice the virtue of obedience, and who had to be sternly ordered to eat and rest or he would have destroyed himself by overpunishing his sinful flesh. Franciscans live on charity alone, owning nothing, not their monasteries, not their plates and cups, or the shoes upon their feet. Carlyle knew this, and watched the monkish gray-brown slide over my servicer dappling, and shuddered.
Come. I opened the door. There's no more time.
They followed me in fear-fast silence. We found not one but 3 of the Chevalier's men lurking in the hall, enjoying a long bench of rose-pink satin, pocked with buttons like navels repeating along an infinite torso. This bench lined the near wall of the corridor from end to end, breaking only from the doors of labeled rooms. Salon Hogarth, Salon Caligula, Salon Rochester, Salon Salome, Salon de Pompadour. The far wall was one great window, looking down over the central hall below, where stairways, landings, and balconies descended like the terraces of Dante's hell, all covered with flesh. The lovemaking took place in piles, 2, 3, 4 lovers at a time, throwing themselves into the vastness of skirts with the glee of kids swimming in chocolate. Men and women of both sexes paraded in the most elaborate gowns and wigs and coats and tails, or what remained of them, as bodices and breeches opened to bear their ready cargo. Many were not even in the act of sex, but simply lying upon each other, dining and gossiping amid the spectacle. Waiters threaded among them, bussers, jugglers, a contortionist, and the Royal Belgian String Quartet, performing here with far more vigor than they had shown at Ganymede's party. Never, reader, have you seen so many people in one place, and not a single frown. "They can't see us," I reassured as I led. "This hallway is the middle level, for club members of more importance. That down there is the Hall of Venus, though the Chevalier's men call it the Flesh Pit. It's the lower clients' level. It's all legal, carefully monitored and hygienic, guests and employees subject to strict health inspection and all that, and our doctors claim a weekly visit does as much for body and mind as a sensor. It's invitation only, word of mouth. But we get all sorts here. Of course, no one of any real consequence stays down in the flesh pit level for long." I glanced back. "Are you familiar with the 18th century author Voltaire?" "Not really," Thisbe answered, drowning Carlyle's yes. "They were the patriarch of the Enlightenment," I explained. "So influential, they not only dominated literature, but could virtually force the hand of royalty, the law, even the church a bit. Voltaire was also a deist, which means they believe that all religions are different understandings of the same universal God, who made the world, but doesn't really care what name or names he's called by." "Mycroft," Thisbe interrupted, "why are you telling me this now?" I did not have time to pause. "Late in life, Voltaire built a small church on their estate. After so many churches built to saints, they said, it was about time someone built one to God. They put an inscription over the entrance, Deo erexit Voltaire, built for God by Voltaire. In a sense, it's the high temple of deism. Strange as it sounds to say that a religion which combines most all religions could have a high temple." We had reached the center of the house, where the wall of doors and couches opened on our left to a grand staircase leading up to a level as far above ours as ours was above the flesh pit. A purple carpet led up past trickling chandeliers to a double door at the top, framed by a marble arch and the inscription, Deo erexit sad. We did not have time for shock and silence. "Immediately to our left," I whispered, "is a small door leading to a secret stairway, which will take you to the street. To our right is a very heavy candelabrum. If you club me over the head and run, you should make it out before anyone can follow." Thisbe stepped closer to me, and I prayed the blow would come. "The Marquis de Sade was from the 18th century too, weren't they?" "You'll also need this," I continued, letting them see a small envelope in my hand. "It's a more powerful memory eraser than the one you use at home, Thisbe. Very safe, no side effects. Blank 70 minutes thereabouts. You can't just go now with what you've seen, but if you both take this in the car on your way away from here, then all this will never have happened. I'll take care of the rest." I waited, counting my breaths and hoping I could count on Thisbe to do just the right amount of damage. I waited. Surely she would strike. Carlyle would not, of course. The censeur had crossed Jehovah's threshold. He stood no longer in the 24th century, but in his. Carlyle, like Voltaire, will not trade knowledge for ignorance, not for all the happiness in the world. Thisbe, though. The threat of the Marquis might scare off even such a creature as Thisbe. I waited. "I thought you said we didn't have time to dawdle, Mycroft," she said, at last her voice soft. "Which way to Madame?" And her answers. I did not have the heart to look at them. "This way." I led them to a landing halfway up the stairs toward the inscription, then turned to a secondary stairwell on the right. A dainty flight of steps took us to a door paneled with pastoral scenes of courting gentry, and a vestibule beyond with cherubs flirting in a painted sky. "I don't intend to leave your sides at any time, but just in case I can't avoid it, a few survival rules. Never allow yourself to be taken to a room where there is not at least one fully clothed woman, by which I mean someone dressed in female clothes, regardless of anatomy. The men here have to behave themselves when there are women present. Second, avoid male-clothed residents wearing black. It is Dominic's privilege to allow them to wear black, so the more black they wear, the more Dominic likes them, which is usually a danger signal. You forget, never turn off your tracker," Thisbe added, doubtless shooting a glare at the cousin, though I did not look to see. I shook my head, the habit's fabric rough against my neck. "They're masters of this. They'd get you to take it off. If they tried, they could even get you, Thisbe, to take it off." I looked to Carlyle. "I know when to surrender." "I was lying before about that stuff I said the Chevalier's men would do to you. I was trying to scare you away. This place isn't like that. The Chevalier wouldn't have harmed you. He would never break his word to Sister Eloise. And you're right that they couldn't rape and kidnap people without getting caught. They wouldn't, either. It's uncivilized. You're standing in the bubble of the 18th century now. They pride themselves on being more civilized than the 25th. "What would they have done to me, then?" he asked after a pause. "They would have kept bullying you a bit. Then one would have played protector, stepping into your rescue. Most cousins love that. Your rescuer would have taken you aside and been the most tender and charismatic person you'd ever met, playing on your fear and gratitude while the others placed bets on whether or not you'd consent. My money, if I had any, says you would have consented. But if you refused, they'd just have sent you packing with a tender warning to be good from now on, and curiosity would have had you back here within the day." "I wouldn't have consented," he insisted predictably. "I'm not that stupid," the universal euphemism for "I'm not that easy." "And even if I were, I don't like boys." I shook my head. "That's no impediment to them. Madame raised gentlemen of both sexes." "What would they have done with me?" Thisbe cut in. There was no fear in her voice, just collegial curiosity, as when a Western fencing master steps into an Eastern dojo and detachedly admires a kindred art too different to be called competitor. "Once they determined you were a person of influence, they would have treated you very well and done all in their power to tempt you into joining. You might like the club, actually, though it does tend to spoil your appetite for any other kind of sex." I knocked twice on the inner door, painted with garlands almost moist enough to seem real. "It's Mycroft, Madame. I've brought the guests." "Just a moment." In those last breaths, I wondered if they would change their minds now, if wise, cold Thisbe would seize a vase from the Pietra Dura sideboard and strike and run at last. I stood just in front of her to make it easy. It was probably impossible for them to make it out from here, but hope is always ready to stifle reason, even in me. Only Carlyle spoke. Mycroft, you didn't answer before when I asked if you knew J.E.D.D.